You're listening to the DeCesare Group Podcast. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jim DeCesare, and I'm glad you're here. You know, we are committed to bringing you in-depth conversations about business and economic activity in South Central Kentucky. I'm excited to bring you this week's guests who are behind a big economic development operation in Logan County. I'm talking about the Halcombe brothers, who operate Walnut Grove Farms. Walnut Grove Farms is a family-based farm based in the community of Shaco in Logan County. The farm is currently managed by fifth and sixth generations of the Halcombe family and operates in two Tennessee counties and four counties in Kentucky. Their production includes corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, and rye. There's also a logistics and hauling component to this family operation. Walnut Grove Farms has a focus on stewardship and sustainability, and they're always on the lookout for new opportunities. As you can tell, there are a lot of moving parts of this sophisticated operation, and it's an honor to have both Sam and John Halcombe here to tell us all about it. Here's my conversation with Sam and John Halcombe. Sam and John, thanks for being on the DeCesare Group Podcast. How's it going?
Doing well.
All right.
Good to see you.
Glad you guys were able to get on here because, you know, farming and agriculture is a big part of economic development, not only in this region, but throughout the Commonwealth. So let's start off with a little history about Walnut Grove Farms.
All right. Well, thanks for having us here. We appreciate the opportunity to come and visit with you. Walnut Grove Farms is a family farming operation based out of Shaco, Kentucky, which we have an Adairville address, so we're in South Logan County.
But y'all have the best Christmas parade in the region.
That's right, right. Make a note of that. That's right. I hope everybody comes to it first Sunday in December.
The Shaco Christmas parade, it's a legend.
Well, can't miss that. Been running for 30, I think next year is going to be 35, or this year will be 35 years.
Awesome. Yeah. So I didn't mean to get off track there, but you brought up Shaco.
Good to be known.
Gotta plug it when you can.
That's right. Good to be known for something.
So tell us a little bit about your
operation. So we're based in Shaco. Not a big place, but big things happen there.
That's right.
Our dad always said that that's where David slew Goliath, so we're used to doing big things in Shaco. So our family's been, John and I have actually done a little bit of genealogical research in the last few months, just out of interest sake, trying to kind of nail down, well, we're both building houses in various stages of building houses on the family farm, and have been working on that project off and on for a few years, actually. So it's sparked an interest in the family history and trying to understand kind of how long our family's been there. So we've traced it back. Our family's been in South Logan, in that neighborhood, probably since about 1810.
Really?
That's pretty well documented back to that point.
That's when let me think about this. That was maybe when Logan County was part of Warren County. I mean, Logan County was one big old county.
That's true. Definitely. That's true. I don't know the exact details and the dates, but yep, you're in the right time frame. And
the free land of Logan.
There you go. So sometime that ancestor of ours that moved down from Fayette County, as a matter of fact, to Logan County, sometime in that 1810 to 1820 sort of time frame, acquired the farm where what we call our home farm today, which is the farm that our mother lives on and the farm that we're in the process of building our own houses on and so forth. So that we didn't call it Walnut Grove Farms back then, but that was kind of when the family arrived. And some branch of our family's been farming right in that area and on that same farm ever since. So John and I trace ourselves back and makes us about the eighth generation farming in South Logan.
In over 215 years.
That's about right.
Yeah.
About right.
That's awesome. So the name Walnut Grove, were there walnut trees on the farm?
So on another farm that's just a couple miles away where our office is. You've been there and visited with us. So there was a family whose last name was Dran, spelled D-R-A-N-E, but they pronounced it Dran. Mm-hmm. And that family had what they called Walnut Grove Stock Farm because there was a grove of walnuts there on the farm.
Okay.
And we've been on that farm for about 95 years.
Okay.
our family has now. But the Drans preceded us there, and our parents adopted the name Walnut Grove when they set up the entity of Walnut Grove Farms in the early 90s, and they adopted that name from the Dran family's Walnut Grove Stock Farm.
That's amazing. So how many acres does your operation make up?
Today we operate about 9,000 acres.
Okay.
We raise corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, rye, and then we have a couple of partners that we work with, Orlando Melon Company. We raise some watermelons with them, and then JKL Pintos, a family friend, longtime family friend of ours. We've started raising some edible beans, some pintos and black beans over the last few years.
All right. And so 9,000 acres, and is it all Logan County?
No.
No. Spread out pretty widely spread. Some in Tennessee, and then about five different counties in Kentucky. So
okay,
we're pretty wide geographic spread. Some of that's by design, and some of it's just happenstance. But you know, it has its pros and cons. Keeps us on the road a lot. Keeps us moving around. But it also diversifies our weather risk. Sometimes it, you know, we have good crops in one area and not in the other area for due to rain and other things. So yeah, we're kind of spread out,
kind of all over the place. And I would assume that creates some logistical challenges as far as getting equipment around and harvesting and all that fun stuff. Talk a little bit about that.
It definitely takes some planning. I mean, you know, so we've kind of, as this has evolved and as we've spread out north to south or south to north, we've kind of figured out, you know, a timing and an order of doing things. We try to start in the south and work our way toward the north, and go along as the season goes along. And I guess to go back a little bit on the history and how the business has evolved over the years, kind of, you know, each generation, as we look back, has the business model has changed, or at least every generation or two, it's kind of evolved a little bit. You know, I mean, originally when they were there in the early 1800s, it was, you know, but they probably didn't consider it farming. They were just, it was subsist. They were living, you know, I mean, it was just how they got by. And then our grandparents and parents are the ones that really brought it into, kind of created the family business that we have today, kind of started that path. And so today, we the operation is spread out south to north. We'll start early in the spring in the south and work our way north as we go. And as we have figured out how to move equipment around, it's changed the business and made it easier to expand into other areas too. So
I got you. So when the family farm originated in 1810-ish, how many acres did you all have then?
Well, so that home farm that we talk about, that the one where our mother lives, is about 400 acres today. Mm-hmm. Not all of that was came together at the same time in the same tract, but probably in that 250, 300 acre range.
Okay.
At that time frame, yeah.
And so you've just expanded out since then. And so talk a little bit about, you know, your operation, because I know a little bit, having known you guys for about 6 or 7 years now and what you all do, but, you know, it's not only farming, but there's logistics, and that's a big part of what you all do is hauling stuff around. So tell us a little bit about that.
So as John and I and our wives, the four of us, integrated back into the family business with our parents over the past 15 years, as John said, there has been sort of an evolution in our generation as there was in previous generations. But the way that things have evolved today and the way that we sort of have division of responsibilities today is we have two areas of focus, we call it. We have the crop production side of the business and we have the services side of the business.
Okay.
So my wife and I focus mostly on the crop production side. John manages the service side for the most part. John's wife does all of our HR stuff. That's her background, and we're lucky to have her in that role. And then, but of course, the crop production and the services sides complement each other, and there's a lot of overlap. But of course, John mentioned the crops that we raise, and that's what we do on those acres that we manage. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't own all those acres. We have a lot of excellent land partners that we work with, whose land we raise crops on. But aside from the crop production that we touched on already, I'll let John sort of explain what he does on the services side of the business.
Yeah. What services do you provide?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another thing that has evolved over time. So mom and dad had started a feed mill back in the early 90s. They were in the hog business in that time frame. And they also started a small trucking company just as a really a division of the farm. I mean, we had to have trucks to operate.
Exactly.
Exactly. And so dad was a really innovative guy, though. I mean, he was always interested in, you know, all kinds of things and looking at ways to diversify or specialize or whatever. And one of the things that I think is interesting, probably 15 years ago, he got interested in taking the crops that we were growing and trying to find premium markets, trying to find something that was one of the things I've thought about is that he was kind of a foodie before that was really a thing, before people came up with that term. And, you know, so he was really interested in the crops that he was raising. And he had always been really interested in small grains like wheat and barley in particular. And around the, 2012, 2014, he went to a malt conference because he was curious to see if there could be a premium barley that he could produce in this area, because he had raised barley for a long time but had gone into the feed market. But he got to know some malt houses, and it was kind of the beginning of the craft beer boom. Mm-hmm. And so there were craft malt houses that were supplying specialty, locally grown barleys. And that kind of put us on a track that has led to where we are today, where we raise a lot of specialty crops that are going to malt houses, are going to distilleries. And then another one kind of adjacent to that is we've been raising seed soybeans for a long time, for the past few years. And Sam's wife, Stephanie, really kind of manages that organization of that piece of it. But we've really kind of started to focus on specialty markets with our production side of things. And as we got into doing that, it kind of naturally led to what we call our services business today. So for these premium markets that we serve, that we grow for, some of them want cleaning services for the grain that they get. They need a higher spec grain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's everything from having the right moisture to having clean grain means we're taking out any foreign material. So like corn, for example, it won't have any stalk or cob or anything like that. We have to run it over a cleaner. And then we also do the final mile delivery kind of things. And in all that, we also got into some rail transloading, because we were working with a grain company that was importing grain for distilleries in Kentucky and Tennessee, and they needed somebody to unload rail cars and do the trucking, do the grain storage, and then the final delivery. And so we started doing that in about 2016, I think. And in 2019, we actually bought a facility here in Bowling Green where we can bring in the rail cars, unload the grain, put it in grain bins right there on site. And so that kind of created this new division that we call Walnut Grove Logistics. Mm-hmm. That is both rail transloading, and then also we consider our trucks to be part of that. So these days we have seven of our own full-time trucks that are doing deliveries every day. And then I've got another six or seven owner-operators that work with us on a regular basis too. So on a given day, we're running somewhere between 12 and 15 trucks making deliveries around the Kentucky and Tennessee area, up and down I-65 primarily.
And when you talk about your rail service, you're talking about the Memphis Junction location.
That's right, yep.
And so you all took that over, and I know from being out there, y'all kind of renovated it and brought it back to life. Was it dormant when y'all took it over?
Not exactly. I mean, the history there is also a really neat story. You know,
it's been there a while.
The reason it's called Memphis Junction is because it's where the main line, what's now CSX, was the L&N Railroad. The Bowling Green Rail Yard is right there. Mm-hmm. And then there's a split to the short line that goes toward Memphis. And so where that split is, they call Memphis Junction, and that's where our property is located. So technically, we're inside the rail yard. We're in this wedge right where the rail splits. So that's Memphis Junction. And, I mean, it's a phenomenal location. So We're right on the parkway, and which is like 3 miles, you know, down the parkway to I-65.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you know the story of the I-65 corridor. We're within, you know, a day's drive of what, 70%
of the top,
Yeah, it's an incredible spot. So, you know, I think that, and really we bought the spot from the previous owner. His vision was that, you know, logistically, this is just a key spot to be long term. And so that's been interesting for us to kind of get into that world a little bit, and learn more about that. I mean, I was a little nervous about getting involved with the railroad, not knowing anything about it, and but it's worked out really well. The crew there is really good that we work with, the CSX guys, and so that's been a good experience. And we've been able to expand from the grain that we handle there. We also handle some premium pet food ingredients that are brought in from out west and come into the pet food in this region. And then
we got a couple of pet food plants in the area.
Exactly. There's actually quite a bit here in this region.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then we also have gotten into handling some steel coils, and we've handled other feed ingredients. So yeah, we've kind of had a lot of interest from various industries over the last few years since we've been there. And that's kind of, you know, it's something we're learning about, and certainly diversifies our, you know, a definite diversification from the farming operation.
Yeah.
So
talking about, you had mentioned that you have grains brought in for some of your customers by rail. Are they coming from other places in the country, overseas, all of the above?
All of the above, yeah. So primarily, our initial product that we were bringing in there was rye that was coming in from Canada, coming in for the distilling industry in Kentucky and Tennessee. And so that was the main grain that was coming in. Now we also handle some malted barley that's coming in. It comes from out west, primarily up into Canada, and then actually now we've gotten some in from Europe that comes across to North Carolina, or it has, you know, it can come in any different port as long as it can get onto the rail and then ship to us.
Yeah, so like maybe come through the Port of Savannah and then rail this way and then get on a truck and and goes to your customers, which is a nice segue. And talk about who your customers are. If you know, there may be some you can't mention, but you know, talk about who you're working with.
Sure. Well, I mean, we would certainly be remiss not to mention on the farm side of things that our key customers are the landowners that we work with. I mean, and those have been our customers for generations. And many of the landowners that we do work with were families that our parents had a relationship with. In some cases, our grandparents had a relationship with. So those are key. I mean, they're almost like family in and of themselves, you know, some very strong long-term relationships there that, and we certainly look at those as customers.
Yeah. And great partnerships, I'm sure.
Exactly. In addition to that, you know, many things we've already alluded to, but we do serve a variety of different industries. And as John talked about, we have looked for the opportunity to move more of the products that we produce into what we call premium channels. So, you know, we were looking at the malting industry years ago, and that's worked out. It doesn't amount to a huge volume of our grain production, but for 10 plus years now, we've been selling a fair bit of our barley into the malting industry with the craft malt houses in the southeast that John talked about. And some of that finds its way into the brewing industry, some of that finds its way into the distilling industry. But then through that, we also realized that the distilling industry itself was a pretty good fit for us, because they are premium customers. They want a premium grain. Mm-hmm. In many cases, not the services that John mentioned about cleaning and delivering and those sorts of things are key services. But the other services that we have been able to provide in a lot of cases are things like special varieties of grain, special varieties of corn or special varieties of barley that they want grown for certain reasons. We've grown some heirloom corns, for example, which is essentially an antique corn. If you think about an heirloom corn compared to a modern day corn, it's kind of like a Model T car compared to your modern day car. That's a pretty good analogy, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Big difference
in terms of how it performs and everything else, you know, but it can be fun. So we've done some of that. So the distilling industry is a, is a premium channel for us. A lot of our wheat goes to Seymour Milling Company in Hopkinsville, which is a great thing for South Central Kentucky farmers and Kentucky.
The batter capital of the world.
Yep. So it's there. You know, they were a premium customer for us before we even, you know, ever since the early 90s when they moved into town in Hopkinsville, mm-hmm. and it was before we were even thinking in that vein. But they continue to consume a lot of our wheat. So yeah, a lot of different good opportunities and to work with a variety of different industries.
That's awesome. So, you know, there's been a lot of changes in the economy over the last few months under the new president. A lot of good things happening, but the tariffs are starting to have an impact on some industries. And are they having any impact on you all at this point?
Well, uncertainty is probably the best way to put it at this moment in time. I mean, I don't think uncertainty is good for business. You know, business doesn't like uncertainty.
No, it doesn't.
So that's one thing. Generally speaking, I don't really think tariffs are a good thing either. Exactly what the impacts of the current tariffs that have been discussed are going to be, we don't really know yet, I think, because it's kind of been on again, off again, and we're still in that transition phase, I guess.
Yeah.
But tariffs aren't going to be, it's hard to see how tariffs could be good for grain prices. We certainly know Trade War One a few years ago was not good for grain prices. Mm-hmm. And of course, it goes a lot further than just grain prices. I mean, affects the economy in general. It's not good for distilling either, because distilling is largely dependent on exports, similar to crop production.
Yeah.
And so it's got the distilleries pretty nervous as well. But the uncertainty is, it's hard to work with uncertainty.
Yeah, and we, you know, I think we've all heard that there's one distillery in particular that did a big major layoff because of the uncertainty. Yeah. And, you know, with you all, you know, sometimes bringing grains in from Canada, obviously that may have an impact. It may not. I don't know. But, you know, those are things that you all have to work out and or look out for, and then, you know, it impacts your business model.
There's definitely been, you know, over the last couple of months, especially as, you know, the on again, off again tariffs with Canada, for mm-hmm. example. I mean, yeah, some of the grain that's coming in is coming from Canada. And so, you know, it's been windows where it was like hit the brakes and then the tariffs are pulled off. And so it's rushed some stuff in, and then because they might be coming back. And I mean, Sam's right. I mean, uncertainty is just the word of the times. And, you know, so I think we and the companies that we work with are all kind of playing around that. And, you know, I mean, in terms of investments and the industries, I mean, this area and the industries that we're in have boomed over the last 5 or 10 years. And I think a lot of that right now is just sort of, you know, the boom is kind of on pause as everybody's kind of waiting to see what happens. What are the policies going to be? And nobody can outguess right now what it's going to be tomorrow. So.
Yeah, we're not there yet.
And purely from a crop production standpoint, I mean, a lot of our fertilizers come from overseas. Potash largely comes from Canada, for example.
Uh-huh.
And so tariffs drive up production costs.
Yeah.
At a time when things are already out of whack, because production costs are higher than grain prices are at the moment anyway. So the ag economy is struggling at the moment. Grain production is struggling from a economic standpoint, and higher input costs due to tariffs is not helpful.
And that's, you know, I guess at the end of the day, it just gets passed on to somebody else, through your sales or services.
We don't have a lot of ability to pass it on in many cases. to some extent, yes.
You still need to be profitable. So
it definitely varies by industry. I mean, I think, definitely some industries are more capable of passing that on than others. And, you know, I think purely from a crop production standpoint, you know, farmers tend to be price takers. And so if the markets aren't there, if export markets aren't available, and that's a third of the commodity crops like corn and soybeans, then that's, you know, you can't just demand a higher price because it costs you more. I mean,
yeah, our prices are largely tied to Chicago.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, we don't have a lot. We can provide extra services and add value to those crops and try to eke out a little extra margin that way. But it's still going to be based on Chicago price,
which
right now input costs are above Chicago price. So that's a challenge.
I can imagine it being a big challenge. So talking about how different factors impact what you all do, what's the future of your business looking like, or the industry for that matter?
Well, we're optimistic about the future. Farmers are eternal optimists anyway, I think.
But, good.
I mean, so this is a good time to give a few shout-outs here. First of all, our mother. So we got three generations of the family involved in the business currently.
Okay.
Our mother, ourselves, and our wives. And then I've got three children. John's got two, so there are five grandkids coming along. A few of the folks that are on our team are actually connected to the family members as well. So we've got a strong...
And multi-generation team members also.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got an excellent team of people that work with us. We're very fortunate and blessed to work with the folks that we do. And I can tell you, we wouldn't be right here on this podcast right now if that weren't true, because this is a busy time on the farm.
Yeah.
And those guys are running the show.
Nice sunny spring day, and you're hanging out with me.
Yeah. So we're lucky to have a good, strong team of people.
Yeah.
And we are thankful for that every day. And that's one of the key reasons that I think the future's bright. I mean, we've got, from a family perspective and from a team perspective, we got a bunch of great people to work with. We've got another generation of our children that are coming up and have interest in the farm and the family business. So I do think that the future is bright. I mean, farming's cyclical, agriculture's cyclical.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, exactly. I think that's the key point. I mean, we're in it for the long haul. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, we're the eighth generation, and we don't plan to be the last generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there have been a lot of ups and downs.
Nobody wants that deal.
Over the last 200 years, I mean, this isn't the first time that there have been challenges. So it's just part of the business, part of the industry. And, I think we're in it for the long haul. And there are, you know, whether it's, you know, the ag economy itself, it'll turn around. It'll come back. It always has. It always will. Or, you know, the services side of the business, where we're talking about what we do with logistics at Memphis Junction. And, you know, I mean, it's Bowling Green is just this area, this region is an incredible spot to be. And so we're certainly optimistic about that side of the business too, long term. I mean, you know, it's a good spot to be.
Well, and knowing that your customers are in the distilled spirits and malted beverages, the good news out of there is when times are good, people drink, and when times are bad, people drink. So
that's what they say. That's what they say. Yeah.
So you might always have a customer base there.
No doubt.
Tell us a little bit about your operation as far as your manpower. You've touched on a little bit about. How many people do you employ, and what kind of, you know, impact does that have on your community and on the region?
So we employ about 24 people at the current time. About six of those are seasonal and the rest are full time.
Okay.
And it's about a half and half split between the crop production side and the services side of the business.
Okay.
We've got a great team of people. We're thankful for that. And, so as far as
they keep the operation,
they
running.
Keep the operation running. That's right. Exactly.
Including you too. So, real quick, and I should have asked this at the beginning, but tell us a little bit about your background. You know, what is your background? You know, I know it's farming, but, any special education, university, any prior experience?
So John and I both grew up on the farm. Mm-hmm. As I was growing up, truthfully, my passion was trucks and tractors. I didn't really care a whole lot about the agronomy or the business or any of those other sides. I was passionate about trucks and tractors. And when I got out of high school, I went to a community college in Illinois and studied to be a Caterpillar diesel technician.
Okay.
And worked at Wayne Supply as an apprentice during that time, which is now Boyd Cat.
Yeah.
So I did that. Then my father, his influence wore off on me, and I finally decided that he was right, that I probably should go on and get a 4-year degree. And so after that first 2 years was up, I did transfer my credits and got a 4-year degree in diesel and heavy equipment technology with a minor in business. And then, with the Caterpillar background, I was lucky enough to go to work full-time for Caterpillar Incorporated, which is where I met my wife. That was probably the best thing that came out of that.
Yeah.
she was working at Caterpillar as well. So I worked at Caterpillar for 6 or 7 years after that, and came back to the farm in 2010. So didn't really go to school for agriculture. Obviously was in FFA and ag classes and things in high school, but had more experience on the equipment side before coming back to the farm.
And where did you go to 4 year?
Pittsburgh State University in Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Yep.
Okay.
They had it's a 4 year university. Kind of reminds me of Western, to be honest with you. But they had a good technology program that allowed me to transfer my credits. And so that's how I ended up there.
So the guy that was into the equipment and, you know, working on it is handling the crop aspect of it. And then John.
Yeah. So, so
you're over the equipment,
right? Right. I get to handle the equipment. We it's a diversification thing, you know, I went to University of Missouri and got an ag business degree, and I did take some agronomy classes. And when I got out of school, I did a lot of internships and spent time in DC and spent time overseas. And I was really interested in, like marketing, grain marketing, Chicago, that kind of marketing, not promotional marketing.
Right, right.
And really interested in that, interested in policy decided that after doing some internships in DC, I decided, you know, actually I want to do something more like actually business related. I didn't want to go to DC and go that route. And so I ended up going to work for a big grain company when I first got out of school, went to work for Bunge, in their trainee program. And then, not long after that, but they started me out in Owensboro, Kentucky. And their argument there was, their standpoint was that they hire all these farm kids right out of college and ship them off, you know, to work somewhere else. And the kids get homesick and they end up leaving and going back to the farm. And they kind of did the exact opposite with me, because I'd already gone away from home to go to school in Missouri. And I was wanting to go farther abroad and get into other things. And they shipped me back to Owensboro, Kentucky to start out. And so I was close to home and got involved with some projects that Dad was doing on the farm. And so that actually drew me back to the farm pretty early. Dad was doing some biofuels research stuff. And so I ended up going to work for a small startup called Mendel Biotechnology that was looking at cellulosic ethanol production. So I ended up spending about 5 years doing agronomic research on a crop called miscanthus, kind of all over the eastern half of the U.S., traveled around a lot. That turned into a job with BP Biofuels for a little bit. And when they were asking me to move to Houston, I decided, well, maybe I want to go back to Kentucky instead of going to Houston. So I ended up going to work for the local John Deere dealership in a roundabout sort of way. And they knew I had done a little bit of international stuff, had some international experience. So they hired me to be their export manager. So I spent about 5 years with them doing exporting equipment, essentially. And then my long-term goal, though, for a period of time was that I wanted to come back to the family farm and be a part of the family business. I mean, that's really what I was interested in. I really wanted to come back and work with Dad and Mom and just be a part of the business itself. And, you know, I never was really sure exactly when long-term was going to be until it, the long-term plan, until the time came and then I made the transition. So, my wife and I came back here. We moved back to Franklin in 2017 and I came back to the farm full time in 2018. So,
going back to my experience at Caterpillar, other than meeting Stephanie there, which was obviously a good thing, but I spent a lot of time at Caterpillar working on services marketing. So we were learning how, I worked in the product support part of the business, and we were studying and working on how to sell services to the customers. And so that services marketing experience really ended up serving us well, you know, that's been some of the things that we studied there at Caterpillar, we've brought back and implemented here working with our premium customers. And so you just never know where life's going to take you. You know, you are right. I'm doing the agronomy stuff and John's the agronomy guy and we got that. And I'm the equipment guy and he's doing the equipment stuff. So it's sort of, you just never know, but, it's always good, I think, to be open to new ideas and try new things, and you just never know where you'll end up.
John,
something he said kind of reminded me. I mean, you never know where things are going to go and what conversations or chance meetings or whatever, or where things are going to lead. But through my grain experience thing was part of what made the connection. One of my friends, when I was working for Bunge, worked for another grain company, and that's kind of what led to the rye handling that we do. And, you know, I think that's just one of the things when you're having conversations like this about kind of the history and how things come about. I mean, that's something that you just never know about those chance meetings and where things, who you know and what conversations you have, and somebody can call up and say, hey, by the way, I heard about this. You might want to try it out, you know? And anyway, it's,
there's a good book called Fluke.
Yeah. Okay.
That I can't remember the author, but it talks about how just, you know, one little chance encounter can change the whole trajectory of your life. But, you know, I think it's interesting that both of you all had experiences, and I abroad, domestically and internationally, that, you know, led you back to where you started. And, having those experiences and with three well-known companies, I guess, on top of that, between the two of you, that created opportunities and relationships and knowledge and experience that's you're putting into play today.
We're doing our best. It's been fun anyway.
And I know
keeps us busy.
And I know Sam, you and I guess we met back in 2017, 18, 19, I can't remember the exact time, but we met at an economic development conference.
Right.
So, you know, that goes to show how far agriculture has come, because typically we're not seeing farmers at economic development conferences, but you all been pretty active with economic development activity too, because I think you understand that there is a correlation between agriculture and economic activity within not only this region, but the U.S. and really throughout the world.
Right. Yep.
So
completely agree.
All right. Well, did I leave anything out?
I think we've covered a lot of ground.
We have covered a lot of ground, and I really appreciate you all being here today and talking about what you all do, because I think it's one of the things that we don't talk about enough is the impact that agriculture has on our economy. And it's broad, and it covers a lot of entities, even in the industrial sector, such as the milling operation in Hopkinsville. What's it called now?
Seymour Milling Company.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Hoptown some, so it was Hopkinsville Milling Company, Sunflower and all that stuff, and they're the batter capital of the world or something like
right.
that now. That's what they're calling themselves. But anyhow, Sam and John, thanks for being on the DeCesare Group podcast.
We appreciate you.
Thank
inviting
you very
us.
Much.
Yes, sir.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks again to the Halcombe brothers, Sam and John from Walnut Grove Farms in Shaco over in Logan County, for joining us this week on the DeCesare Group podcast. And thank you for checking us out. Hey, if you like what you hear, please share it with a friend. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a review and share your feedback with us. You can also follow the DeCesare Group across all of our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, X, and YouTube. You can even subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Soakie Economic Development and Business News, by going to our website, thedecesaregroup.com. The DeCesare Group podcast is produced by the DeCesare Group, a public relations and consulting firm based in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Our engineer with the green thumb is Justin DeCesare, with content contributions from Brooke Mattingly. Our producer and writer is Amy DeCesare. I'm Jim DeCesare, and join us again next time for the DeCesare Group podcast.